This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
The idea of tipping points in nature are now well known. The most feared include a sudden shift in global temperature, a breakup of polar ice fields, or release of frozen methane. But such sudden regime shifts happen in a huge range of natural systems. Fisheries suddenly collapse or a species unexpectedly goes extinct. If we can predict these tipping points, perhaps we can stop some of them or at least reduce the impact. A whole school of scientists have been working on this problem for several decades, since our future may depend on the answers. Recently, a body of work led by Martin Scheffer, Jay Brock, and V. Carpenter tried to analyze these rapid shifts, searching for leading indicators which could help us predict danger points. Our guest, Professor Alan Hastings from the University of California, along with UK co-author D.B. Weisham, suggests, quote, drastic changes can appear in nature without warning. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to explore this new and worrying research. The paper published in Ecological Letters is titled Regime Shifts in Ecological Systems Can Occur with No Warning. Dr. Hastings, thank you for joining us.
Thank you as well, and that all sounds fine.
Okay, we got the introduction right. That's good. Good place to start. Well, I know that most of my listeners want to know right now whether we can predict when big systems will react to things like carbon pollution in the atmosphere, but that is jumping to conclusions. I'd like to start with an orderly outline of what your paper does say, beginning with that idea of tipping points. How do we know they exist, and could you give us an example?
So one simple example of a tipping point is changing what was not a desert into something that is a desert. If you look in the historical record, the Sahara did not used to be a desert, and by looking at the historical record, you can see it rather rapidly changed from an area with a fair amount of vegetation to the desert that it is today. And this is one prime example, and others, as you pointed out, are collapse of fisheries, and another one is a changing of a lake from its normal state to a eutrophied state where it's full of algae and other organisms.
Well, Martin Scheffer and others have been saying that we're making progress on our mathematical models and other ways of knowing when these leading indicators will happen. And your paper, if I get it right, doesn't say that that's wrong. It's just that prediction may not work for many complex systems. Is that right?
That's exactly right. There are many systems where you can begin to hope that you could understand a simple shift in regimes. And those are ones where, if you think of a ball at the bottom of a valley, it will sort of slide back and forth. And if one side of the valley starts getting lower and lower and lower, one of the mountains on the side, eventually the ball will start to slosh around more until that it will then find its way out. And this is the picture that Martin Scheffer and others have. And it applies to some systems, but unfortunately, many ecological systems, that picture is too simple a picture of the dynamics. And more complicated dynamics mean that this picture just does not apply and the ball can sort of jump out in unpredictable ways.
So you created models that included some known stresses and then some random or unknown factors. And what did you find?
Well, we found that two things. One is we started off with a general argument that draws on some old work that physicists had done to say that the picture I just described of essentially a surface of where a ball rolls around is far too simple, and that there are cases where you have the kinds of strong interactions that ecologists would look at, and the ball would just sort of jump out, that there is no smooth surface. And what we did is we put in the kinds of interactions of strong density-dependent, strongly interacting species that ecologists assume describe ecological systems, and we found regime shifts occurring with no early warning signs, as the general theory predicted.
And your models were based on population. I guess this could apply to fish, algae in a pond, or even humans.
Yes, it certainly could apply to fish or algae or pond and humans and potentially human interactions with diseases and any sort of complex system, even to things like financial markets.
I was interested in your third model, which included three species linked in a food chain. The top predator went extinct without warning. What does that tell us?
Well, that tells us that once you begin to look at the kinds of interactions that ecologists think about, we looked at one, two, or three species, but food webs and natural systems may consist of hundreds of species interacting, some of them quite strongly, that you can find relatively sudden disappearances without these early warning signs that you hope to see in general systems.
Well, given that whole species or ecosystems may depend on prediction of regime changes, especially if those models are used in resource management, say by governments or corporations, how do we know, and I know this is the key question, how do we know which ones can be safely predicted?
I think that we have to go away from looking for general signs and for trying to find very simple explanations to looking at much more careful study of particular systems and using the general ideas in looking at those particular systems, but not thinking that we can find simple signs that carry across to different systems.
Well, this is one of the subtle points of your work. You're saying that each system is so complex that it might as well be considered as unique.
Well, each system is complex, and each system has to be looked at carefully, but there are principles that apply across systems. Sometimes I like to think of this as the idea that we have principles that tell us how to build complex physical structures like bridges or build tall buildings or other complex structures, and the same principles apply, but you would not expect a bridge to behave the same way as a tall building.
All right, I think I understand that. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about tipping points with Dr. Alan Hastings from the University of California. You know, Alan, my reaction to your paper is to worry a bit more. If science can't tell us when tipping points are approaching, that means nature is more unstable than we thought. Does this call for more caution when trying to set limits, whether it's for fisheries or for carbon in the atmosphere?
It certainly suggests that there should be more caution and much more careful monitoring of dynamics and much more attention paid to when any potential shifts seem to be occurring.
Well, bear with me for a second here. I know you're a well-respected scientist with a long list of published papers, but when I look over some of your past work, I can almost picture a man who often concludes, "It's hard to say." Except, and correct me and if I'm wrong again, it seems you organize the science, sometimes spending up to $1 million, to prove that some predictions about nature or any complex systems are beyond us for now. And that isn't what funders and the public really want to hear. So the truth is more difficult than we want it to be. Is that partly your point?
Part of the point is that the truth is more difficult, and we have made quite a bit of progress in my own work as well in trying to understand more specific systems. And what we're saying is that just much more care is needed in developing the tools to make the kinds of predictions that we need to be able to make. And in many cases, we have used these ideas to get a better understanding of specific systems ranging from the dynamics of marine populations, where you can set up simple approaches based on things like marine protected areas that will work in many circumstances.
So you're not advocating that we all need to learn chaos theory. There are some underlying rules that we can go by.
There are underlying rules we can go by, but understanding the complexities of dynamics is going to really help us to understand the natural world around us.
And I also thought, I wondered whether your work is a little bit subversive, and I say that because science is nothing if it's not based on prediction. We say if such and such is true, then we should find this, some testable state of affairs. But some of your work seems to cut off this last leg. If we can't say when complex systems will react, is science still really possible and worthwhile?
Science is definitely worthwhile, and what we are not saying is that prediction is impossible. What we're saying is that we have to understand the kinds of predictions we are able to make and the time over which we can make the predictions. Just as a weather forecast gives us perhaps accurate predictions over a couple of days, but not over weeks, that gives us one sort of understanding. But on the other hand, we also have the kind of prediction that it's colder in the winter and warmer in the summer, and we can also make that kind of prediction. So we need to understand carefully what the kind of predictions are that we can make and use that as tools in management.
Well, you're reminding me of some comments that Sir James Lovelock made to the BBC. He said that really to just make a straight up graph of global temperature and then say what's going to happen from that, it could be foolish because there could be sudden jumps that we hadn't expected at all. And I guess that goes pretty well with the work that you've been doing.
Absolutely, that goes well with the work that we've been doing, where we're trying to understand the best ways to make predictions. And in one sense, the prediction that tipping points do exist is itself a very useful piece of information.
Well, I realize my next question is beyond the scope of your paper, but I want to ask if you personally believe that the next few years or decades could experience sudden and disturbing shifts.
Yes, they can. I do worry about that, and there are various signs of potential problems that would cause serious shifts, ranging from changes in ocean circulation, which is potentially very worrying, to other changes even on much smaller scales in terms of cascading effects of species extinctions and changes in species ranges.
And as you said, it looks like there's plenty of room for your theory to grow. I mean, people could use it perhaps in economic markets or predicting things like oil price spikes. Do you see that there are other applications coming along for it?
Definitely. I think that trying to understand how you predict and how you manage complex interacting systems is a field that is just beginning to make real progress.
Well, have we really touched on what you would like to say to the public, or what have we left out? What would you like to add?
I would simply like to add that we definitely should not give up on trying to improve our ability to predict. And also that we've reached a stage where the human influence on the natural system is so great that just sort of trying to leave it alone as much as possible is not going to provide the kinds of safety that we need, and that we're going to have to think seriously about developing much more active management strategies for natural systems.
Well, I suppose that's the saying, if we're going to be gods, we might as well act like gods. We're going to have to do more interactive management, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, and we're doing that in terms of marine areas, and we're going to have to do that more globally, perhaps.
Our guest has been Dr. Alan Hastings, Distinguished Professor of Environmental Science and Policy at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Hastings, thanks for a better understanding of the big picture, even if it is harder than we hoped.
Thank you as well. I enjoyed talking with you.
There are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. Don Rumsfeld, a tough act to follow.
We're already running low on time. Before we get to James Lovelock, let's run quick clips from James Hansen on the most excellent program, Late Night Live, hosted by Philip Adams, on March 8th, 2010. Find it at abc.net.au, because this is the Australian Broadcasting Network. The interview followed a lecture in Adelaide. James Hansen is the director of NASA's Goddard Space Center and the first scientist to warn the American government about climate change. Here we go.
But we could pass tipping points this century. In fact, we could pass them very soon. We could pass them within the next few years, where the ice sheets would become unstable, for example. And because of the chaos and economic and social chaos that would come about if the ice sheets become unstable, because so many of our cities are on coastlines, including Australia, by the way, that it may, the governments may just lose control of the situation. And that's a real danger.
James, we're having this conversation in Sydney. Sydney is the capital of New South Wales. New South Wales can be seen, particularly from the air if you're flying down from Brisbane, as one immense coal mine, because we just dig up anything anywhere, and coal is always wins. We are vastly increasing our coal production capacity, new railway lines, hugely improved or enlarged shipping facilities in places like Newcastle. Many of us are involved in what feel like futile efforts to slow this juggernaut down. You regard coal as the biggest problem in the world, much larger than nuclear.
Absolutely. It's the biggest source of carbon dioxide. It's the one, I say those trains are death trains, because we can see what the impact is going to be if we exploit fully the coal resource.
We're getting rid of it, though, Jim. We're sending it overseas.
Well, you see, before we realized...
Shh, don't tell you.
Before we realized that the problem, the climate problem, then you couldn't blame people. But now that we understand the consequences of continued and increased exploitation of coal, we are responsible, and we need to recognize what the implications of that are.
But, Jim, you're being such a pessimist here. The coal problem has been solved. Clean coal.
That, of course, is a way in which they've been able to fool the public into thinking that they're working on a solution to the coal problem. The Bush administration had a clean coal program.
They got rid of it, though, after a little
and
while.
And then at the end of their term, he simply canceled it, because they didn't really do anything during the 8 years.
Cannot we sequester?
Carbon capture and sequestration is worth investigating, because we may need to use that with biofuels, because we're going to need to draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. We've already passed into a dangerous zone, and we can see that the ice sheets are going to be unstable, even if we just stayed at 390 parts per million. So we could burn biofuels in a power plant, capture the CO2, put it underground, and we would draw down in that way the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. But I don't think that using it with coal is going to work. It's going to make the coal so much more expensive that other alternatives would be preferable.
This is what you call your fee and dividend approach, isn't it?
Right. There needs to be a fee which is across the board, so there's no monkey business the way there is in this ETS, carbon cap schemes. Put a fee at the mine or the wellhead or the port of entry, and the money that's collected then should go to the public, either through a monthly green check or a payroll tax deduction. It preferably needs to include a monthly green check, because half the people are either unemployed or retired. So you wouldn't catch everybody if you just used a payroll tax deduction. But in the United States, tax reductions are very popular, so maybe you could use half the money for payroll tax deduction and half for a green check.
I've been talking to James Hansen, who is running this global conspiracy, whose whole purpose is world government, which he will run, global domination, by James Hansen, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, adjunct professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia, and at Columbia's Earth Institute.
That was NASA's Dr. James Hansen in conversation with Philip Adams of Late Night Live. And it's just a sample of the full recording, available as a free MP3 download from ABC National Radio in Australia at abc.au.net. Google it or find the link in my Radio EcoShock blog for April 8th, 2010. Go to ecoshock.org and select blog from the homepage. You can also find all my past radio programs there as well, for free, of course. Load up your MP3 player, computer, or iPod with Radio EcoShock. Share it with your friends. Spread it around. There is no copyright on this work. On the British Broadcasting Network, James Lovelock, the 90-something British scientist, inventor of the Gaia Theory, has condemned most of you to death. So it's time for our new feature,
12 Batty Things About James Lovelock.
Number 1.
James Lovelock hates wind energy. Those whirling blades damage the perfect sky of the English countryside. He can join the Kennedys, fighting off clean energy, while...
2.
James has never had a bad word to say about oil companies. Biting the hand that feeds, he's contracted with them from time to time, you know. Used to be an old Shell oil man.
We've sort of pulled the trigger. We're not really guilty. It wasn't, we didn't deliberately set out to heat the world. But as a result of what we've done to build our civilization, we've set things in motion.
3.
Climate scientist Peter Ward says Lovelock's ever-loving Gaia that always balances itself is actually Medea, the mother repeatedly killing her own children. Gaian balance comes through mass extinctions up to 90%.
Number 4.
Ward told Radio EcoShock Lovelock is getting a little batty.
But Dr. Lovelock in Seattle was on radio saying the most unbelievable things, saying that right now China is buying up Africa because in the next 20 to 30 years, China will transfer all its population to Africa. Now, he said this publicly on the radio and then in front of a crowd. Now, he's right in saying that climate change is a big problem, but when you say that China is about to colonize Africa with a straight face, I mean, you lose a whole lot of credibility.
5.
Lovelock's late-life dream that jolly old England will be spared the climate disaster is an old-time empire joke. Buildings dry since the Middle Ages have already been flooded. Nobody escapes.
If it looks that warming really has set in, and Europe's becoming uninhabitable, as many of the modellers seem to predict it would, then a lot of things are going to start changing. One of them is going to be absolutely massive migration here. Now, we'll have some of the best farmland still and a climate that's suitable for growing it. So it's going to be a very different sort of nation in the future if it moves in that sort of direction. And if, on the other hand, the climate moves as it's now and we're going into a cold period lasting, shall say, 50 years or something, then all bets are off. We just carry on more or less as usual and hope for the best.
6.
James is so sure of England, the climate sanctuary, he wants the government to build rows of new hospitals and schools to be ready when the rest of Europe and maybe Africa too moves in. That's what he says.
7.
Lovelock's climate nightmare, expressed with unblinking clarity, is that 7 out of 8 humans will perish due to climate change. The food die-off, diseases, wars. Not the English, of course, but those other people.
But if it really does warm up as badly as I've said in that book it might well do, then we'll be lucky if there's 1 billion left.
And that's so in other words, 7 out of 8 will die.
Yes. Well, something like that, if it happens, yes.
And they'll die because of a combination of things, because of rising seawater, because of extreme weather, because of floods.
Mostly from starvation, I think.
And because
Starvation and disease,
yeah.
The four horsemen.
Yeah.
And, of course, wars will occur when you're already seeing it in the Sahel sort of war. Global warming is forcing the migration of tribes into regions where the people who live there at the moment don't want them.
8.
James Lovelock says we're too stupid to survive, except him. He's not stupid.
Number 9.
Lovelock immediately volunteers numbers were fudged by the East Anglia climate crew when a parliamentary commission reports this did not happen.
10.
You see, science has changed in our lifetime. It used to be a vocation, rather in the way nursing was a vocation. You did it almost as a calling. You had your own discipline and rules of behaviour. When I started science, most scientists would consider it a sin against the Holy Ghost to fudge data. But the moment it became a career job, which it did during the last century, then if you were under pressure and your job depended on your producing the right results, you tended to adjust the data to fit what your bosses wanted.
And that's what's happening now, is it?
I suspect. Well, it certainly happened on a grand scale in the CSC ozone affair. And I leave it to, you're much more experienced in people than I am.
Not
would
in
you
this
have
field.
Expected them all to have changed dramatically in the period since? I don't know.
But you're the scientist here.
Well, yes, but I'm an old-fashioned scientist in every sense. I'm one of those that did science as a vocation, not as a career.
Lovelock condemns the very climate scientist who taught him his final day's vision. James depends very much on the vast array of climate scientists, the teams who run satellites, to feed information into his dark vision. But he says scientists should be few in number, independent soloists like himself. Except Lovelock has been hired by giant corporations and governments.
11.
In the BBC interview, Lovelock let slip that CFCs were really not so bad, just a victim of bad press, perhaps. Despite the ozone hole, the older Lovelock tries to rewrite the chemical history of the atmosphere to blank out the hole in his conscience when the young James Lovelock testified for the big chemical companies to the US government, saying CFCs were harmless.
And number 12.
It's sensible now not to buy one of these gas guzzlers, because it's going to cost you if you do. And I think that motivation is probably more effective than trying to save the planet, which is just a lot of nonsense.
Why is it a lot of nonsense?
Because we can't do it. If it's going to be saved, it'll save itself, as it always has done.
But that's saving the planet, not necessarily, as you say, saving the people on it. And you distinguish very clearly between humanity and the existence of humanity and the existence of the planet.
Absolutely, I do. We're full of hubris and think we can do these kind of things. But we're not clever enough yet to do it. And I don't think we will be in time in this particular event. So I think the sensible thing to do is to enjoy life while you can.
James Lovelock announces, it is all too late. A giant climate shift will wipe out most of humanity, so we should, like himself, enjoy ourselves while we still can. Just a minute. That is where I draw my line on the blackboard. This past week, my first grandchild was born into this world. I have held his tiny hand and promised little Liam, I will never raise the white flag of surrender. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'll be back next week and the week after that. Lovelock, it's time to retire. A new crew is coming on board, and we never give up.
And I cause nothing but trouble. I understand if you can't talk to me again. And if you live by the rules, it's over, then I'm sure that that makes sense. I will go down with this ship, and I won't put my hands up and surrender. There will be no white flag above my door. I'm in love, and always will. And I won't put my hands up and surrender. There will be no white flag above my door. I'm in love and always will be.